Welcome to the Brain Bag Podcast. My name is Andre Gunawella. I'm being joined by my co-host Ryan Rosenthal, as always, and we are very happy to be joined by Professor Rashid Khalidi. He is a professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University. He received his PhD from Oxford in 1974. He is the co-editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies and was the president of the Middle East Studies Association. He also served as an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to Madrid and Washington during the Arab-Israeli peace negotiations between 1991 and 1993. He is the author of many, many great books, the most recent being The 100 Years War in Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017, and his seminal work, The Palestinian Identity, The Construction of Modern National Consciousness, is also a really great book that you should all check out. Professor Khalidi, we're very happy to be joined by you today. We're looking forward to the discussion ahead.
Thanks for having me.
So Professor Khalidi, I want to start off on a personal note for you. I mean, you of course are a renowned academic studying this issue, but it's also a personal and a family issue. And so, of course, your grandfather came of age during the Ottoman rule over Palestine. And so I think I want to begin by just a discussion about how his past, how his experiences in the land of Palestine have shaped you and your family and your career.
My grandfather had a traditional religious education. He was taken on the Hajj to Mecca by my great-grandmother. And he served as a judge, first in the Ottoman administration and then later in the British mandatory government of Palestine. He ended up on an appellate court with one British, one Jewish, and one Muslim judge. But he believed in education. In fact, he wrote a great deal in the press about the importance of education. And he sent almost all of his children, except I think the eldest two, to modern Western schools. Most of them, including my father, graduated from the American University of Beirut, and many of them went on to do medical training, or my own father did a PhD. So my grandfather, while having a traditional religious education, was very interested in modern education and showed that with the training of his children.
Absolutely. And that's very good to hear. And sort of now I want to sort of go into and ask you the question of about Palestinian nationalism. But first, I sort of want to start off with who actually are, quote, the Palestinians? Who are the people who are the Palestinians? Because I think we sort of hear like different sort of commentators talk about this, but we want to get your perspective on this. Like, what are the myths, the realities, and so on?
Right. Well, a lot depends on how you understand nationality and ethnicity and identity. Most modern nationalisms have a mythology which roots the peoplehood of the modern nation in some largely mythical ancient origin, such that the French talk about their ancestors, the Gauls, such that Italians talk about the Roman Empire, such that Israelis talk about the Bible, such that Palestinians talk about the Canaanites and the Jebusites and the Philistines. Modern national identity is a modern thing. Most people did not think of themselves in the terms that they do today as modern nations inhabiting nation states 200 years ago. In other words, people in France thought of themselves as subjects of the king of France. Some of them didn't even speak French. Some of them lived in principalities that were only under the French king because of marriage or conquest or purchase or whatever. The same was true in the Ottoman Empire. Same was true in the Romanov Empire, the same was true in the Habsburg Empire, the same was true in Britain in the 17th or the 18th century. The British brought in a Dutchman as their king in 1688. The idea that you had to be an Englishman to rule England simply didn't exist. I mean, there was an idea of English, of England and of Englishness, but the idea of a national being someone from a national origin and a group could only be ruled by somebody of that ethnicity did not exist. Later on in the 18th century, they brought in a German to rule. So it was religion, in fact, that determined those things. They didn't want a Catholic. That's why they brought in a Dutch Protestant. That's why they brought in a German Protestant. So the idea that the modern nations, the modern nation states, the modern ethnicities have always existed is a myth. Modern national identity is constructed. That's true for the Palestinians. It's true for everybody else, without exception. In the case of the Palestinians, you had a place called Palestine, like you had a place called England. The definition of it may have differed over time, changed over time, but people didn't see themselves as rooted politically in that space. They saw themselves as belonging to that space. And that was true of most people most of the time up until the modern era. In the modern era, you have the idea of modern nationalism, that people should live in a state defined by a single ethnicity and language. And that has come to be the case all over the world. So Palestinians, as I argue in the book you mentioned at the end, Palestinian Identity, like most Arab peoples, like most African peoples, like most Asian peoples, like almost everybody else, came to think of themselves in modern national terms only at the very end of the 19th century, very beginning of the 20th century. That's actually true of their rivals. Most Jews thought of themselves as part of the Jewish people, but didn't see that as determining their nationality, where they should live, who should rule them, that they should live in the land of Israel. Most Jews did not and didn't think that they should live under any of those circumstances, within a Jewish state, in the land of Israel, only surrounded by fellow members of that people. That's a modern notion. That's a modern nationalist notion that in that case, as in the case of most other nationalisms, was influenced by the French Revolution, was influenced by the growth of modern nationalism in Europe, and came to be developed into modern political Zionism. Case of the Palestinians is analogous. The case of Syrians, Lebanese, Egyptians is also analogous. So we're talking about people who lived there for a very long time before that, in the case of Palestinians, but who thought of themselves, as I say in the book, in religious terms, or thought of themselves in terms of locality, I'm a Jerusalemite, or I'm from Hebron, or I'm from Nablus, or thought of themselves in family terms, or thought of themselves as part of the Ottoman Empire. So you were Christian, or you were Muslim, or you were Jewish, you were from this or that place, you belonged to this or that family, and you were under Ottoman rule. And that's how people thought of themselves before the rise of modern nationalism, pretty much all over the world.
So if we look at the two quote-unquote competing nationalisms in Palestine, we have, of course, Palestinian nationalism and we have Zionism. But, you know, I think depending on who you ask, there are different time periods in which you see the emergences. Some will say that Zionism led to the emergence of Palestinian nationalism, but you, of course, argue that, you know, they came of age at the same time. But should we look to the Ottoman period to kind of say this is when we had the emergence of these nationalisms, and what necessitated this emergence in the land of Palestine?
Well, I think it was, as with many nationalisms, it was contingent. If Hitler had not arisen, Zionism would have remained a minority ideology among most Jews. You know, before the rise of Nazism, many Jews felt that the only possible refuge for Jews was in the creation of a Jewish state. They were a tiny minority. Most people either believed you couldn't live here, so you emigrated, 4 million of them, 4 million Eastern European and Central European Jews emigrated to the United States. Hundreds of thousands of others emigrated to Latin America or Canada or Australia or elsewhere. Others hoped to assimilate. They became socialists, they became Bundists, they became communists, they were not politically involved. A tiny minority were Zionists. So the contingencies of European anti-Semitism, the contingencies of, in particular, the rise to power of Hitler and then ultimately the Holocaust, converted people, as it were. Similarly, contingencies created what we today call Palestinian or Lebanese or Syrian or Jordanian nationalism. Those identities were not preordained. There were people living in Jordan. There were people living in Palestine. They saw themselves as linked to that place, but their political identity could have developed otherwise. And in each of these cases, I think contingency determined the outcomes. Now, no Jordanian or Israeli or Palestinian nationalist would ever accept that true, correct historical explanation. But, you know, I don't care what they think. That, in fact, is probably the best historical explanation. And so this identity developed over time in response partly to Zionism, in response to the way the Ottoman Empire was being transformed, in response to the arrival of modern notions of nationalism, in response to relationships with other emerging nationalisms within the Ottoman Empire, Turkish nationalism, Arab nationalism, and later on Syrian and nationalism and so forth. So it was a contingent response of people living in Palestine to the frontiers that were imposed upon them. Palestinians didn't choose their frontiers. the British and the French determined the frontiers of all of those countries in what were formerly Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire under the Sykes-Picot Agreement and subsequent Anglo-French Agreement. So all of these contingencies helped to develop what we today call this firmly rooted identity of Palestinian nationalism. The same is true of all the other nationalisms in this region, Greek or Serbian or whatever. In many cases, you have peoplehood, Armenian peoplehood, for example, Greek peoplehood. But the idea that that necessitated a Greek or an Armenian national state did not exist in the 17th or 18th century at all. This is a modern notion.
So yeah, so you certainly say it's a modern notion, and I sort of want to dig further into perhaps, like, you know, what are the more profound myths and realities around this idea of Palestinian nationalism, but also, of course, with Zionism, and like, what, how have those myths and sort of those, like, I mean, I had a professor, John Mearsheimer, who often said history is sort of truth telling while nationalism is myth making. So how have, you know,
an old colleague of mine.
Yeah, I just wrapped up his class this past quarter, actually. But how have these myths transcended into potentially, like, sort of exacerbating some of these conflicts we're seeing right now?
Well, I mean, there are a variety of myths that are at the root of nationalism. Some of them are, I guess you'd call them historico-archaeological in nature. So, for example, Turkish nationalism is very much rooted in a presumed connection to the Hittite period, because one of the greatest ancient civilizations that arose in the territory of what is now the Republic of Turkey was the Hittite Empire. There's absolutely no connection between the modern population of the Republic of Turkey that we know of and the Hittite Empire. But it is seen as one of the roots of modern Turkey, and there are regions called, you know, named for the Hittites and so on and so forth. The same is true in Palestine. The very name of Palestine, which is originally a Roman provincial name, is derived from the Philistines. We have no idea what the connection between the modern Palestinian population and the Philistines or the Canaanites or the Jebusites or all the other people we read about in the Bible. What that connection is, but it's that connection has been appropriated by the modern national consciousness, and there are books that talk about that as if it is a real connection to the modern era. It is, in terms of people's imaginary, of course, and that's obviously true of the Bible and an understanding, or the Quran for Jews, for Christians and Muslims, in terms of their self understanding. It's particularly important, of course, in the case of Israel. Because there is a connection. There's a connection between Judaism as a religion and the land of Israel. It originates there. The same is actually true with Christianity. And so for both of them, as well as for Islam, this is a land that is seen as holy. This is a land that's seen as blessed by God. This is a land that's seen as the site of most of the patriarchs, most of the prophets of the Hebrew Bible, as well as of Jesus. And it's a site that's also connected, which means it's sacred to all three monotheistic religions. And that religious, that religious connection is incorporated into both modern nationalisms, both Israeli nationalism, Zionism, and Palestinian nationalism.
So if we begin to look at Mandatory Palestine and life under the British Empire in this territory, things begin to change rapidly for the what became the Palestinian people and what became the, you know, the now Israelis who were at that time really Zionists. And I think something that you point out is that this is a history of settler colonialism.
Right.
And that's a term that we've heard before in many different instances. And certainly in this scenario, it can be, you know, very provocative. But I think your book does a very interesting job of kind of laying out why that's not necessarily pejorative.
Right.
It's just it's a historical fact. And so if we kind of go through this, I want to kind of focus in on how external actors, whether it be, you know, the United States, the British Empire, maybe the French, had an influence on the development of Zionism from what seemed to be kind of a sideline nationalism into what became the creation of the State of Israel.
Well, that's a multi-strand question. Let me answer each of its strands in sequence. First of all, the British play an enormously important role. In the Hundred Years' War on Palestine, the book that was just published a year ago, I argue that really you have to begin the history of modern Palestine and of the modern struggle over Palestine with the Balfour Declaration, with the British conquest of Palestine during World War I, with the declaration by the British government that it would favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and with its derogation of the overwhelming majority of the population to subordinate status. The 95% of the population that were Arab at the time of the Balfour Declaration in 1917 are not described by name. They are not described as having national or political existence or rights. They are described as only having civil or religious rights, whereas the Jewish people are named as a people with a right to national existence by the British. And then this is later incorporated into the mandate for Palestine that's granted to Britain by the League of Nations. So I describe this as a war of declaration of war on the Palestinians, because what it in effect meant was that Britain by force was going to impose an entirely new dispensation on Palestine, in which there was one people entitled to national existence in Palestine, and the others were there essentially on suffrage, without national rights, without political rights, even though they were the overwhelming majority of the population at the time. And that's a role that Britain continues to play right up through World War II in enforcing this new dispensation. And at the end of that period, from 1936 to 1939, when the Palestinians rose up against the British and against the Zionist project with massive force, 100,000 troops and police, the Royal Air Force, the killing of about 10% of the killing, wounding, imprisonment, and exile of about 10% of the Palestinian adult male population. So Britain is a crucial part of this story. It's usually told as the tiny little Zionist movement up against all these Arabs. In fact, it was the humongous British Empire with the Zionist movement up against the Palestinians. And that was the actual balance of forces in Palestine during at least the first two decades of the mandate. Now, you've also asked a sort of second element, a second part of your question, which is about how these two national projects operated, and why one of them is described as a settler colonial project. And I am arguing for this framework, not just because I think it's accurate, but because it's the framework which early Zionists understood to be correct as well. They saw Zionism as a national movement, which of course it was. They saw Zionism as a means to rescue the Jews from persecution in Eastern and Central Europe, which of course it was. It had very little to do with the lives of Jews elsewhere, for example, in the Middle East. It was essentially focused on the problems of Russia, the Russian Empire, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and of the extraordinary persecution to which Jews were subject in those two realms. But it also was and saw itself as a European colonial project, which was intended to settle Jews in a non-European land. Early Zionist leaders talked about this openly. I quote at length probably the most forthright and in some ways the most influential of them all, a man named Zev Jabotinsky, who's the founder of the political trend that includes every single Israeli leader, with a couple of exceptions, since the 1970s. Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, Ariel Sharon, Benjamin Netanyahu, Ehud Olmert, and if he becomes prime minister, Bennett himself. All of these people are heirs of a tradition founded by Zev Jabotinsky. And he talked about the colonial nature of Zionism, even as he argued that Jews had a right to Palestine, and that force was necessary to impose that right, and that, of course, the Palestinians, like every native indigenous population, were going to resist, and only might, only what he called an iron wall, could force them to accept what he himself described as a colonial endeavor. And I talk about how this self-description was not embarrassing until after World War II, until after a shift towards decolonization, when nobody wanted to be colonial. Even the great colonial empires tried to recast themselves. So the British become the Commonwealth rather than the British Empire and so forth. Up until that point, major institutions, like one of the major land purchase institutions of the Zionist movement, was called the Jewish Colonization Agency. No embarrassment at all. So this is neither slanderous nor derogatory. It's simple historical fact. This was a settler colonial movement. Its project operated like other settler colonial projects. Its intentions were to replace and displace the indigenous population. It made no bones about that. Herzl didn't talk about a Jewish Arab state. His book was called A Jewish State. He said, we should control immigration. We should be sovereign. Our objective is to, he said in his diaries, spirit the native population across the frontier. So all of these things are inherent in Zionism from the very beginning, even as at the same time, it is both a national project and an attempt to rescue Jews from the persecution that was their lot in Eastern, in particular Eastern and Central Europe.
So when we frame these historical events like that, the Palestinians against this big humongous force that were the Europeans in essence, and we sort of move on into 1948 for the Israelis to work independence for the Palestinians, the Nakba, we see that UN resolution and early attempts at creating a Palestinian state. But why did those early attempts fail? And what did Palestinian agency actually look like? How much control, I mean, we talk about the Europeans, but how much control did the Palestinians have their own agency, especially when we see sort of the other Arab states coming into play during 48 and after 48?
Right. That's a good question. That's a good question. And it's very misunderstood, I think. Firstly, I mentioned the might of the British Empire crushing the Palestinians in the 30s. The effect of that crushing defeat of the Palestinian National Movement from 1936 to 39 was still being felt in the mid-1940s. Many Palestinian leaders were never allowed to return to Palestine. The ones who were dead were dead. The best and the brightest were either killed or exiled, and obviously couldn't come back, the dead ones for sure. Moreover, the Zionist movement went from strength to strength. The British armed and trained militias to use as auxiliaries against the Palestinians, and that is the backbone of what later becomes the Israeli army. There's a huge tradition of self-fashioning in Israel. Well, Israel was self-fashioned. Zionism, in a sense, created itself. But it did so with vast assistance from external forces. I talk in the book about the amount of capital that was pouring into the Zionist project in the 1920s. The amount of capital annually imported into Palestine by the Zionist movement was greater than the GDP of the Jewish sector of the economy. Imagine, every year you were getting more capital investment than the entire production of your economy. That's a lot of external help. It was coming not from Britain. This is coming from money raised by the Zionist movement itself. And in that sense, it is self-fashioning. But the armed forces were not self-fashioned. They were built up with the assistance of the British to help them crush the Palestinians. And that becomes the backbone later on of the Israeli army. And it's recognized by the Israelis because the man who was most important in doing this, a British officer called Ord Wingate, is honored all over Israel. He's talked about as one of the founding figures in the Israeli military tradition. So the Palestinians had agency, obviously, but they had been defeated by the British. The Arab countries, who are often talked about as this large coalition of strong, independent countries, first of all, most of them were not even independent during World War II. They become independent in the subsequent period. Britain, for example, had given independence in 1922, had given Iraq nominal independence in 1932, but continued to occupy both countries and control them directly or indirectly. So they really weren't independent. They were under the British thumb. The same was true of Syria and Lebanon. In fact, the French tried to retake Damascus, bombarding it for the third time in 20 years in an attempt to crush independent Syria in 1945. And it's only because the Security Council forced them out that the French eventually left in 1946. So these were barely independent, if even nominally independent countries. So that's one side of the balance sheet. On the other side of the balance sheet, the Zionist movement, which had developed strong contradictions with Britain as a result of the British White Paper of 1939, developed an alternative set of sponsors in Moscow and in Washington. And it was the United States and the Soviet Union that pushed through the 1947 partition resolution. It was the United States and the Soviet Union which recognized Israel immediately after it was established. And it was both countries that armed the new state. So from having as a patron the British Empire, Israel comes to have as its patrons the two great superpowers of the post-World War II era. So again, We're not just talking about the plucky little Israel fighting all these powerful Arabs. It is plucky little Israel, if you want, fighting relatively weak Arab countries. In fact, the balance of power, the balance of forces on the battlefield was close to even, if not slightly tilted in favor of the new Israeli army when the Arab forces entered Palestine on May 15th, 1948. Several of those armies had their arms tied behind their backs. The British insisted that the Jordanian army and the Iraqi army, which were probably the two best Arab armies, never cross the frontiers allotted to the Arab state under partition. So Israel was able to fight the Egyptian army, drive back the Syrians, who hardly counted for that matter, and really faced the Jordanians only when they had to take territory that would have been part of the Arab state. And so many, many losses in the Israeli army are taken as Israel advances into areas that were to have been allotted to the Arab state. Now, people often ask, why wasn't an Arab state created? Well, one reason it wasn't created was because of the fact that the Palestinian National Movement had been crushed by the British. Another reason was that the strongest military force on the Arab side, which is the Jordanian army, the so-called Arab Legion, was actively seeking, Jordan, I should say, which controlled the Arab Legion, was actively seeking to take over Palestinian territory. King Abdullah had this as his ambition since the 1930s, and he did not intend to allow the creation of a Palestinian state. So Israel didn't want it. The British didn't want it. The British armed, trained, financed, and officered Abdullah's Arab Legion, and Jordan didn't want it. And so the way I describe it is that the state was strangled in the cradle before it could, you know, develop. The other thing to point out is that I think what the United States and the Soviet Union intended in crafting the partition resolution, which sort of gives you the birth certificate for Israel and would have given a birth certificate to an Arab state, what they actually intended was really to create a Jewish state. They didn't care about an Arab state. They had no particular interest in it. The resolution made no provision for the conflict that erupted immediately after it was passed in November 1947. It made no provision for intervention to stop the fighting. It essentially did nothing to prevent that state from being aborted at birth. And the Soviet Union and the United States, which were intent on seeing Israel created, didn't care about an Arab state. They had no interest in it. So there are many reasons why it was not established. Something called the Hukumat Umum Palestine, the government of all Palestine, was established by Palestinian leaders in Gaza, but it didn't get very far. And so no Arab state was created. Jordan took over the West Bank. Israel, which had been allotted 55% of Palestine under the partition plan of 1947, expanded to 78%. And Egypt, the Egyptian military administered what became the Gaza Strip. So no Palestinian state was established or could be established.
I think it's now important to then kind of fast forward to the emergence of the PLO in order to understand, the resumption of efforts by the Palestinian people to concoct some sort of state or at least engage in some sort of process. And so how instrumental was the PLO? Of course, it's not in existence anymore. Was the PLO in moving forward the Palestinian cause? And I guess Arafat, when we look at Yasser Arafat in particular, had an outsized role until, of course, he was, you know, killed.
Or died. We don't know.
Right.
Well, Palestinian nationalism certainly went into eclipse after 1948. The defeats of the 30s and then the crushing defeat of Palestinians in 1948, the dissolution of Palestinian society under hammer blows of what later became the Israeli army and the ethnic cleansing of most of the population of what was to become Israel was a devastating blow to the Palestinians. It's known in Palestinian historiography as the Nakba, as the catastrophe. The population that comprised 65% of the total population of Palestine was driven out. Most of them were driven out of their homes, lost their property, became stateless, or became citizens of Jordan in the case of the ones in the West Bank. And whether they were inside Israel as second-class citizens of the Israeli state, about 150 or 180,000 of them, whether they were living in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip, or in Jordan, or Syria, or Egypt, had no apparent political agency. The PLO and the groups that comprised the PLO came along to remedy this, to renew Palestinian agency. This is a process that starts in the late 1950s, with small independent groups that later coalesce and take over the PLO, which initially, by the way, was formed by the Arab League as an attempt to contain Palestinian nationalism, to make sure that the Palestinians didn't cause trouble to the Arab governments, which were mortified, petrified by the idea of being dragged into a conflict with Israel, which, you know, we have this image in the United States of tiny little Israel. Most Arab countries were very scared of Israel. It had soundly defeated them in 1948. It then soundly defeated Egypt in 1956, and nobody was enthusiastic for a return match. And the Palestinians and their activism and their nationalism and ultimately their attacks on Israel threatened to drag the Arab countries into a conflict none of them wanted or was ready for. And so Palestinian nationalism at this point really had to fight on two fronts. It was not only obviously opposed to Israel, but it was also having to deal with the reticence and the fears of the Arab governments. And it ultimately managed to recreate a unified Palestinian national movement in the mid to late 1960s. And that the PLO later on becomes successful, not just in asserting itself as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, but in putting the Palestinian people back on the world stage with diplomatic recognition, with recognition at the United Nations, as Arafat gave his famous speech in 1974, and with the diplomatic offensive that, you know, essentially reestablished that the Palestinians were a factor in this panorama, where Israel had hoped that the Palestinians were gone, and that all that was left was an interstate conflict over borders between Israel and Arab countries, and the old issues that were raised in the 1940s and before would be forgotten. The PLO, the emergence of the PLO, ensured that that would not be the case.
So the PLO did bring the Palestinians back to the world stage, and like diplomatically, they engaged in the Oslo peace process, as we saw sort of throughout the Clinton administration. But the Oslo peace process didn't necessarily bring peace in general. And I mean, you look at sort of the Camp David summit in 2000, and President Clinton and the Israeli prime minister were critical of the Palestinians, Arafat in particular. But what was sort of the Palestinian perspective on why those negotiations didn't go so well?
Well, what happened at Camp David in 2000 was preceded by a whole series of attempts by the Palestinians to insert themselves into negotiations. This starts in the 1970s as the Palestinians redefine their objectives from a single secular democratic state of Palestine, encompassing all Jews, all Muslims, and all Christians, in which everybody would be an equal citizen, to acceptance of the idea of partition and of a two-state solution. And this is an evolution that starts in the early 1970s, 1973, 74. It goes through various stages, and it finally culminates in 1988 with a Palestinian Declaration of Independence, which accepts the principle formally of partition, which accepts that negotiations are the means to achieve it. And this eventually, the United States begins to negotiate with the Palestinians. Israel refuses to do so. This eventually leads under President Bush Sr. and Secretary of State Baker to the negotiations that start at Madrid and that continued in Washington. And this is the background of the Oslo Accords of 1993, these negotiations in 1991, 92, 93. And what became clear during those negotiations to me, I was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation that was, you know, engaged in these negotiations in Madrid and Washington. What became clear to me and to the other Palestinian negotiators in Washington was that the minimum Palestinian demand, which was independent sovereign statehood in the 20-odd percent of Palestine that Israel had occupied in 1967 with Jerusalem as a capital, was something that Israel and the United States were not intending to allow. Everything we did in Washington, in the 10 rounds of negotiations that I participated in, made it perfectly clear that the limits of what Israel envisaged was a form of captive autonomy, with really one sovereign, one security authority, Israeli control of frontiers, airspace, groundwater, everything, important import, export, population register, Jerusalem, and so on. And that you could not get more than that. We, the people negotiating in Washington, were unhappy with that, obviously. And we tried to devise various plans and various proposals that would have pushed things towards independent sovereign statehood. Ultimately, the PLO decided it was willing to cut a deal with Israel on the basis of autonomy, which is what the Oslo Accords really allowed for in a tiny part of the occupied territories, essentially 38 or 39% of the 22% of Palestine, which Israel had occupied in 1967. And those accords, by 2000, had alienated most Palestinians. Palestinians realized this was not going to lead to an end of occupation. This was not going to lead to the end of settlements, taking up more and more Palestinian land. In fact, the size of the settlement enterprise in the occupied territories expanded during the 5 or 6 years after Oslo, such that by 2000, the Palestinians really were completely fed up with the whole Oslo process. So when Arafat goes to Camp David over his own misgivings, he said to Clinton and to the people who negotiated with him, "You guys have no plan to solve this. This is not going to lead to a solution. I'm going to be blamed for it. But you have not opened up a prospect for an independent Palestinian state, which is our minimum demand in a fraction of the entirety of Palestine." And the Americans said, no, we won't blame you. And of course, Clinton and his the people who worked for him, like Dennis Ross and so forth, proceeded to blame Arafat, as did the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. So that's the genesis of the Camp David negotiations. Barak never presented a proposal to the Palestinians. The so-called generous offer was a proposal made to the United States, which then went forward with the bits of it deemed appropriate to the Palestinians. It did not include Israel giving up control of entry and exit, of the population register, of allowing Palestinians to return even to the Palestinian state. It did not include the Palestinians getting back occupied Arab East Jerusalem. It did not include, in other words, sovereign independent statehood. And the Palestinians, in my view, badly mishandled the negotiation, but there was no way they could have accepted this as the final offer. And that was the last really serious attempt to do this. Ehud Olmert, a later Israeli prime minister, engaged in negotiations later on. But at no stage has Israel, for example, accepted to give up control of the Jordan River Valley or of the crossings into a Palestinian state, which therefore would not have been a state. If another country controls your airspace and entry and exit and import and export, you're not a state. You're some kind of subordinate, like Indian nations within the United States. They're not independent entities. They're not sovereign independent entities. And that's the best that Israel, to this point, has been willing to offer the Palestinians. So the generosity of it is solely in the eyes of the beholder. But we get deluged with this gush about generous offers. There's nothing generous about them.
Professor, I want to begin to round out this conversation by looking towards the future, your mm-hmm. prognosis for peace, or the prospect of peace. But I think it's important, an element of this is the divides between Palestinian national governance. You have, of course, Hamas in Gaza, and you have Fatah in the West Bank. And that struggle is certainly, at least in my opinion, undermines the fate of the Palestinian prospect for their own state. And so I think that's a great way to round out this conversation.
Yeah, I think most Palestinians would agree with you that this division is extremely harmful to the Palestinians. It's partly a function of the selfishness and the lack of national, of adherence to any kind of national loyalty on the part of both leaderships. It's a function, of course, of Israeli attempts to divide and rule, but it's also a function of, as I've just said, of the short-sightedness and selfishness of both of these leaderships and of their complete incompetence. But the physical division of the Palestinians was not created by the Palestinians. The division into people who are citizens of Israel, Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, Palestinians who live in Jerusalem as residents but don't have citizenship, the people who are besieged and blockaded in the Gaza Strip, and the population of the West Bank, as well as the maybe half of the Palestinian people who live outside of Palestine, former refugees or refugees. And those divisions are a problem as well, physical divisions imposed by, you know, the occupier and by circumstances. One of the things that's most interesting in what happened in the past 5 or 6 weeks is the way Palestinian unity transcended those divisions, both the divisions imposed by geography and by the occupier, the divisions that are caused by the stupid internecine feuding of different Palestinian leaderships, and other differences. One of the most striking things to happen during these past 6 or 7 weeks was this general strike that included Palestinians inside Israel, Palestinians in the occupied territories, and Palestinians in Lebanon and Syria. Everybody shut down. It's the first time you had that kind of unified national action since the general strike in 1936 that kicked off the great 1936-39 revolt. and the fact that Palestinians inside Israel or Palestinians in Jordan or Palestinians in the West Bank responded with demonstrations, responded with this strike to what was happening in Gaza, to what was happening in Jerusalem, to what was happening in Israeli cities, cities like Jaffa, mixed Arab-Jewish cities inside Israel, like Jaffa or Haifa or Akka, I think shows that there is a kind of Palestinian unity that transcends these divisions. I think it's interesting to note that before all of this happened in May, elections were planned. They were suspended by the Palestinian Authority leader, who, by the way, his term ended 11 or 12 years ago. He was elected in 2004. His term was to have ended in 2009, I believe. So he no longer is president, in fact, legally. But he suspended these elections. There was enormous anticipation of these elections, and many observers predicted that in the West Bank, where Fatah is dominant, Hamas might have a chance of winning. And in the Gaza Strip, where Hamas is dominant, Fatah might have a chance of winning. Why? Because people are so fed up with both. And many other analysts have said that if there were a serious none of the above category, it would win a majority, i.e. neither Fatah nor Hamas. There was a report, in fact, that Hamas's internal polling said that they expected to lose the May 22nd elections that have not taken place, of course. So I think that the Palestinians are divided politically, the Palestinians are divided physically, Palestinians are divided by the divide and rule tactics of the Israeli occupation. And they're divided also by the fact that external actors play them by creating proxies of Iran, Qatar, Jordan, Turkey, Egypt, every major regional actor, the United States, the EU, all of them have their clients within Palestinian politics. And so the Palestinians have to fight against those divisive tendencies. But I think what happened last month in May shows that there's a kind of Palestinian unity that transcends these divisions. It remains to be seen whether that can be translated into something political. And I think coming months and maybe coming years will tell whether that's the case, as happened in the 50s and the 60s with the emergence of the PLO.
And on that note, Professor, thank you so much for joining us here today. It was very important to hear your very interesting perspectives. And just for our audience, again, I want to highlight the professor's books, his most recent one in 2020, The 100 Years War in Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 through 2017. And one of his most famous works, The Palestinian Identity, The Construction of Modern National Consciousness. Professor, thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.